Again, I'm going to speak to you today about some clinical modes of action relative to in-the-fight infected Tophaceous fescue toxicosis and some possible means of overcoming the problem through the use of cattle genetics. I come to you from Tennessee State University. We're located in Nashville, Tennessee. Those of you who are unfamiliar with the program, we have a small academic unit, and then we have a research program that's pretty diverse. We're actually located in the middle of Nashville, so if you've ever gone through Nashville, you might have seen signs saying Tennessee State University. We've got various research programs going on there, but we're the 1890 land-grant institution in Tennessee. This is an introductory slide that I usually use to start off things with when I'm speaking to various groups. And they're focused on Tennessee, but probably these are pretty much true in your state or on a national basis, where we have beef cattle production in Tennessee being the largest agricultural enterprise in terms of cash receipts, about 20% of cash receipts coming from beef production. As far as support of a beef cattle in the fight infected Tophaceous fescue is widely used. It may be the most widely used forage in Tennessee. And when we put beef cattle together with in the fight infected Tophaceous fescue, as Dr. Hoagland just presented, we have issues of fescue toxicosis. It's going to affect cattle performance and ultimately going to have an adverse effect on profitability in the beef cattle enterprises. To try to avoid a lot of what Dr. Hoagland has already presented, I'll go through a very brief and very fast historical overview of Tophaceous fescue and the problems associated with it. Research began in Oregon in the early 1900s. Actually, Tophaceous fescue probably made its way to the United States during the 1800s sometime. Work started in Oregon, and in the 1930s in Kentucky, work started trying to develop varieties of Tophaceous fescue that may be utilized as forages for beef cattle producers or producers in general. And that led to the commercial release of Alta and Kentucky 31 in the 1940s. This was the result of work done in Oregon, and this, of course, was the result of work done here in Kentucky. Early in the 1940s, the first documentation of in-the-fight infection was published. This was actually work that was done in New Zealand. This corresponded with the release of Tophaceous fescue. It wasn't too long until we started having documented problems of cattle performance and cattle well-being in animals that are grazing Tophaceous fescue. So it didn't take very long after this forage was released that we started hearing that problems were occurring in some of these cattle operations. That led to the beginning of research to try to identify the causative agents of fescue toxicosis. There's a lot of work that had gone on into that area. But it wasn't until the 1970s that the link was made between the end-of-fight and poor animal performance. So we had actually 30 years from the time the end-of-fight was identified until it was actually connected with poor animal performance. And of those early varieties that were released, Kentucky 31 seemed to be the one that really took off. It was called the wonder grass because of all the potential that it posed. It presented for cattle producers. And I guess according to Dr. Hoagland, maybe I should throw this slide out. May be a little bit generous showing, but Tophaceous fescue is widely used and it is heavily used in this region of the country, even though it's found in various locations throughout the U.S. After the link was made between the end of fight and poor animal performance in the 1970s, over the last two or three decades, there were a number of studies, and Dr. Hoagland was a pioneer in this area. When I heard that I was speaking after him, I said, maybe I should just say I agree with everything he says and sit down. But maybe I can add a little thing or two here and there relative to this problem. Well, I went into the literature and looked at a number of studies that have investigated the effect of in-the-fight infected Tophaceous fescue on cattle performance. And here I'm just looking at two traits, post-weaning growth and reproduction. here we have about 32 studies that are summarized here, and we see a pretty consistent reduction in growth rate when we move from animals that are on low or non-infective pastures to high infective pastures. We've got about maybe a 30-35% reduction in growth in general across all these studies. And then when we look at reproduction, again, we have a pretty consistent reduction in reproductive performance in our cow herds. This is averaged over 20-some studies. And we typically see pregnancy rates falling from probably about the low 80s down to the low 60s. There are some occasions where we don't see a problem in reproduction in some particular operations, and there are some cases where pregnancy rates are reduced by 50 or 60%. But on average, we see about a 20, maybe 30% reduction in pregnancy rates. So it's pretty apparent that we've got a problem performance-wise. One of the things that we're trying to address is what exactly is going on in these animals that are causing these problems. We know that there's somewhere between the time these animals are consuming this forage until we start measuring performance rates that we've got a problem. When you look at the grass, it's not obvious that there's a problem there, potential problem. But what we see is that these endophyte-infected tall fescue fields, they're endophyte-infected, or they're classified that because there is a fungus that's actually residing within the plant itself. And it's not obvious to the naked eye. This is only through microscopic examination that you can find this endophyte. So then the next question is, what is this endophyte doing that could be causing problems, could be causing these problems? It turns out that this endophyte is producing a number of toxic agents, ergot alkaloids, that are potentially problematic to the animal. And this is just one of numerous compounds. We have ergovaline and ergotamine that are two compounds that have been identified in endophyte-infected tall fescue samples, tissue samples. So again, go over this briefly because we've already heard this earlier. What are these endophyte-produced compounds doing relative to the grass and relative to the cattle? In terms of the grass, it's all good for the grass. All good. In terms of drought tolerance, pest resistance, we can think of pests in terms of insects. We can think of pests in terms of nematodes. And we may even think of cattle as a pest. I'm sure that the forage would rather not be grazed. And these compounds actually deter grazing. As Dr. Hovland mentioned, we see reduced intake. Cattle just don't like this stuff, and it's because of these compounds that are being produced that actually deter cattle and other herbivores from grazing this forage. When we look at the animal side of the production equation, it's all bad. Fescue foot, fat necrosis, and we have fescue toxicity, which is going to be the primary focus in terms of trying to enhance productivity and profitability in these operations. General signs of toxicosis, high respiration rates, excessive salivation, elevated internal body temperature, usually measured as rectal temperature, rough hair coats or retained winter hair coats, increased time standing in the shade, water, even standing in the mud, less time grazing, and generally lower feed intake. Now let's take a closer look at what's going on relative to some of these compounds that are being produced by this endophyte. There are a number of alkaloids. There's no one alkaloid that's being produced by this endophyte. Here I have a picture of five different compounds that are produced, and there are dozens of compounds. There are several classes of ergot alkaloids, but these are some of the ones that have received the most attention. We have our ergopeptine alkaloids, in which ergovaline is the predominant compound that's produced in this group and the predominant ergot alkaloid in fescue. We have in small amounts, we have ergotamine. Well, I mention ergotamine because a lot of the research at the clinical level has used ergotamine as a model to study fescue toxicosis. We have our lysergic acid amides, ergine, we have ergometrine, and lysergic acid itself. All these compounds pose potential problems. We also have lower trim beans, we have low-lean alkaloids, pyrimine, and a lot of other compounds that are also produced. With these ergot alkaloids, we see a common four-ring structure that is shared by these. And it's called the ergolene ring structure. And it's thought that this ergolene ring structure is somehow involved in the physiological manifestations of fescue toxicosis relative to these compounds. Now I present to you three neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. These are compounds that are normally produced in the body. They act at nerve cells, they're produced by nerve cells, and they cause a whole host of physiological activity in the body. And it's thought, because of the similar structure between these naturally occurring neurotransmitters and the structure of the ergot alkaloids, that it's through these pathways that these ergot alkaloids are having or causing their biological responses. If we look at neurotransmitter-regulated activities in the body, of course, this is all normally occurring in the body, we see that these compounds affect appetite, they affect cardiovascular function, endocrine activity, we're thinking in terms of hormones and hormonal effects, gastrointestinal motility, muscle contraction, and body temperature regulation. That's occurring every day in our bodies as a result of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Now, what do ergot alkaloids seem to do when animals are exposed to these compounds? This list is almost the same. Ergot alkaloids seem to affect appetite. They affect cardiovascular function. They affect endocrine activity. They affect muscle contraction, thermoregulation, and some work out of New Zealand is starting to show that they also affect gastrointestinal motility. So this is supporting the notion that these ergot alkaloids that are being produced by the endophyte are acting through normal pathways or biological pathways within the body to affect our animals. For an example, this is one study that was conducted where steers were fed an ergot alkaloid, ergotamine, and they were trying to induce signs of fescue toxicosis. This was an endophyte-free forage, and they added ergotamine to the diet. And they found the same responses that they found in a group of steers that they fed endophyte-infected top fescue. We had a reduction in skin temperature, we had increased rectal temperatures, increased respiration rates, decrease in feed intake, and the animals that did not have ergotamine in their diet, these animals were gaining weight. The animals that had ergotamine in the diet, they actually lost weight over a one-month period. So this is also going to indicate that these compounds are acting through some biological pathway in the body to affect animal performance. Now, some of the work that we've been doing at TSU has been to look at some of the basic endocrine or hormonal patterns and effects that these compounds might have. Here we have insulin-like growth hormone in cattle that were either treated with ergotamine or not treated with ergotamine, and we see a significant drop in blood insulin-like growth hormone concentrations in these animals that were injected with compounds produced by the endophyte found in tall fescue. And this is one of several hormones that we've looked at. We've looked at insulin, we've looked at cortisol, we've looked at thyroid hormones that affect metabolism in the animal. We've also looked at reproductive hormones such as luteinizing hormone and prostaglandin. And in each case, the ergot alkaloids, when these animals are treated with these compounds, have effects that seem to go along with poor reproduction and poor growth in the animal. And we're looking at this because if we're going to devise strategies to overcome fescue toxicosis, we need to get a basic handle on what these toxic compounds are doing in the animal. And that's the reason why we do these studies with these purified ergot alkaloid compound to see what's actually taking place in the body. So as we're starting to get some basic biological, physiological, pharmacological information on these compounds, we can probably say that at this point that the biological pathways from ingestion of the endophytic fescue to physiological responses have not been completely defined. Ergovaline has been considered the primary suspect in terms of compounds that are causing problems relative to endophyte infected tall fescue. But there is some work out of Georgia that seems to throw some question as to whether or not ergovaline is that compound we really need to be concerned about. And it's based on the ability of this compound to get into the blood system. For these compounds to have their effects, they have to cross the GI tract after they're ingested. They have to get into the circulation and then have their effects throughout the body. And the work out of Georgia seems to indicate that ergovaline, the one compound we've really been focusing in on, doesn't seem to cross the GI tract very well, not in very high concentrations. So that's kind of thrown that into question. But I think we still probably need to look at ergovaline. If we look at the work on ergotamine, when it was fed to the animals, it was causing signs of fescue toxicosis. What we don't know is maybe these compounds such as ergotamine or ergovaline are being converted to some other bioactive metabolite that's still getting into the circulation and causing the problems. But we still have a lot of questions that need to be answered. You know, as we answer one question, two more questions arise. So that's where we're at on looking at clinical mode of action in terms of how we might address the fescue toxicosis problem. Now, looking at it in a more production-oriented sense, dealing with endophyte-infected tall fescue as a C-stock producer, a cow-calf producer, or a stocker manager, because these are the segments that are going to be most adversely affected. The feedlot producers, it's really not a problem for them. They may even get a benefit out of tall fescue fed cattle because the chance of getting compensatory gain. And so they might like to see these tall fescue steers come into their feedlot because they might make a little extra money on them. But it's the seed stock producers, the cow calf producers, and the stockers that really need to address this problem. And we can address it either by dealing with it on the plant side of the equation or dealing with it on the animal side of the equation. Most of the research and most of the focus has been on pasture management strategies. I've kind of grouped them in three general approaches. One is to increase the stocking rate. Increasing the stocking rate is meant to prevent plant maturation and development of the inflorescence in seeds, because the compounds, even though they're found throughout the plant, are most concentrated in the seeds. And so if you can keep the fescue from going to seed, you might lower the concentrations of ergot alkaloids that these animals are consuming. And plus, there's a lot of grass out there since their intake is already down. Ammoniation, this is meant to degrade the endophyte or the alkaloids that are being produced, and plus ammoniation has a general effect of increasing a nutrient quality or nutrient value in a hay. And then dilution or replacing endophytic fescue through the use of either other forages, and Dr. Hovland mentioned the use of clovers. Other forages could be legumes or could be other grasses. Maybe you put in some orchard grass or maybe some warm season perennial. That's one option. You might look at using endophyte-free tall fescue, but there's problems associated with that as have already been noted. And then the newest option is the use of novel or non-toxic tall fescue. And it's being marketed as two or three varieties that are out there now. And so that's an option. You can think of any one of these. But there might be reluctance. Say you've been using tall fescue for a number of years or maybe a couple of decades now. You've got a nice, healthy, robust stand of tall fescue. And just the thought of tearing all of that out and replacing it might be a deterrent to some producers. And so even though this may work for some in some situations, it may not work in all situations. To a lesser extent, work has looked at animal management strategies. What can we do on the animal side of the equation to overcome problems of fescue toxicosis? And I've kind of grouped these into three general categories as well. One includes feed supplementation or the use of feed additives. There are various products that have been marketed that go to maybe supplementing the energy levels or mineral content of the diet. This may even be considered as a dilution effect. Because if you're taking these cattle and you're feeding them grain, that means they're not out there grazing the fescue. So it's almost the same as diluting it with another forage. You're just diluting it with something coming out of a feed bag. The use of hormone implants have been looked at to some extent. Two new products that are either being marketed or being developed. One is a seaweed product where there's a seaweed extract that's being looked at as a possible means of overcoming the problem, and I think it's being marketed now. And then there's a product, I think there's a company here in Kentucky that's working on a yeast cell wall preparation that shows some potential to aid this in terms of a feed additive. Pharmacologicals, there was some early work that was done with ivermectin, not only because of its anthelmintic properties, but specifically because it acts on another neurotransmitter pathway. And it was thought that through what's called a GABA pathway, that ivermectin might be a benefit. And then we've got a couple of other compounds, metoclopramide and domperidone, that have been looked at. This compound was looked at because of its effect on prolactin. One of the primary, one of the commonly found consequences of grazing in the fighting phase of tall fescue, if we have a suppression of prolactin. And it was thought that if we can give animals a compound that would increase prolactin concentrations, we might overcome some of our problems. And this is the newest compound that's being looked at along those same lines. And if those of you that are in the areas of the country, such as Kentucky, where you have a lot of horses, you might have heard of this compound. It's been used successfully in horses and pregnant mares, where you inject mares 2 or 3 weeks before they go into parturition, and it seems to alleviate some of the problems associated with fescue toxicosis in the mares. And it's only just now starting to get looked at as a potential in cattle. And then in terms of immunologicals, there have been some efforts in Georgia and in Tennessee and up in Virginia looking at the possibility of developing some type of a vaccine to protect these animals. But from what I understand, this hadn't gotten very far, and it's going to be a long ways off before anything like this comes online and is available to cattle producers. If we go and think the basic premise of cattle performance and the underlying influencing factors, we know we have the environment and we have the genetics of the animals that we're working with. So one of the approaches that we looked at in Nashville was, what about the genetics? Is there anything that we can do genetically to enhance animal performance or cattle performance on fescue? And one thing I went in and did, and these were some advertisements that I found just over the internet over the past 3 or 4 days, where producers were advertising their animals as excelling on tall fescue. And this is one where they were concerned about fescue, and they said that cattle can, if they can excel on fescue, can excel in nearly all other environments. Had another ad where they were marketing these Angus cattle as being uniform functional heifers that are well adapted to perform on Missouri fescue. And a third ad, we had a bull that was being marketed, and they stated that his performance was excellent, and this was all done on a first calf heifer that was on fescue. And that leads me to discussion of within breed genetic selection. We've got various operations that have been managing tall fescue, managing cattle on tall fescue for generations now. And the question is, well, over time, can we just improve our animals to the point where we don't have the tall fescue problem? There was a bull, and this is to look at some control studies. There was a bull that was reported to be producing calves that did not have the fescue problem. And this bull was put into a control study in Virginia, and they found that in this control study that the producer claims were not validated. This is going back to those three advertisements. Sometimes you really don't know if you have no way of comparing these animals. We can go out and say our cattle are producing well on fescue, but if you have no way of comparing them to some other production scenario, you don't know whether or not you could be getting enhanced performance or not in these animals. So in this control study, the producer's claim wasn't validated. But there was another study in which bulls were tested as being sensitive or tolerant of fescue based on rectal temperature responses. And when these bull calves grew up and produced calves, they found that the sensitive bulls produced calves that were sensitive to fescue. The bulls that were tolerant produced calves that were tolerant. So that seems to indicate that there may be some variation within our breed for responsiveness to fescue that we may be able to exploit, but it's going to take place over a period of generations. And there has been some work in Virginia in mice where over a period of 10 to 15 generations, they were able to develop lines of mice that were resistant to fescue toxicosis or to the ergot alkaloid. They were able to do this in mice, but a generation in mice is only a few weeks or so. If you go to 10, 15 generations of cattle, it might take a lifetime or two to get there. But one thing I should note about those mice that were resistant to the fescue had generally poor performance across the board. So they became resistant to the fescue, but the performance was low. So that's one thing you have to be concerned with. If you're selecting for resistance to fescue, you may be shooting yourself in the foot in some other areas. So we have to be careful when we look at that. But the potential does exist. I'm not sure how far this work has gone beyond this initial pilot report, but the potential is there. Now, a lot of what we see as far as fescue toxicosis seems to indicate that heat stress and hyperthermia is something that we have to be concerned with. Heat stress is exacerbating catalytic graze tall fescue. So we have problems with heat stress and hyperthermia. Maybe we should consider heat-tolerant animals. That seems to be a pretty logical scenario to consider. Interestingly enough, though, very little research has been done in this area looking at heat-tolerant animals in terms of how they perform on fescue. After we've got three studies that have been published that have looked at this in terms of can Bos indicus or heat-tolerant genetics help us out some way in overcoming problems with fescue toxicosis. And what these studies have shown generally is that when you put these Bos taurus animals on the endophyte-infected tall fescue, we have an expected drop in performance. We see about anywhere between 16 to 86% drop in growth rates in steers. If we look at our Bos indicus crosses, they also showed reductions in performance. They weren't resistant. They still had performance problems. But the interesting thing is that the level of reduction in performance wasn't as great. Anywhere between a 10 and 60% difference in the performance of these animals. On average, the Bos indicus influence reduced the problem of fescue toxicosis by about 25%. a 25% reduction through the use of in the fight, or through the use of these Bos indicus animals. One thing I should note is that it's not necessarily a summertime problem. This particular study, we had performance problems. These animals were carried from November to April. So they're actually carried through the winter and early spring. We still had performance problems, and we also had some benefit due to Bos indicus genetics. So that points out that there may be something more than simple heat tolerance that may be playing a role here. There are other tropical adaptations that we need to consider, as well as this, the ability to regulate body temperature. In some of our initial work at TSU, we were interested in looking at heat tolerant genetics. In our research model, which we were taking purified compounds and injecting them into these animals. And what we found was that, generally speaking, these animals, either the Hereford or the Brahman, were both responsive to our ergot alkaloids. When we treated these animals, they had similar responses, generally speaking, in terms of insulin, in terms of our reproductive hormones, in terms of changes in cardiovascular function. But there were two things that really stood out in these studies. When we look at thyroid hormone, we found that the Hereford cattle had increased thyroid hormone concentrations. The Brahma cattle didn't have a change in thyroid hormone concentration. Thyroid hormone is important in metabolism, in metabolic rate. And the other and probably more striking difference was when we injected these animals with ergotamine, we had increased respiration rates in the Herefords. We did not have increased respiration rates in the Brahman cattle. And so that led us to some more chronic exposure studies. The question that would always come up, so, well, you're taking these compounds, you're injecting them into these animals, they're not eating them, they're not going through the process of digestion and that sort of thing, and it's only a one-time shot. These animals are out grazing fescue for weeks at a time, and they're ingesting this stuff. So, okay, we'll go in and we'll do some studies where we're going to put heat-tolerant and heat-sensitive animals on fescue, kind of like what was done with the Brahman cross study we mentioned previously. But we used a different model, a different animal for our heat-tolerant breed. We used centipole cattle. So we can get away from, well, these are Bos indicus animals. We would like to see something that maybe doesn't carry any Bos indicus influence. So we said, we'll go with the centipole animals. They're a Bos taurus breed, and they're heat-tolerant. And so we put Hereford and centipole purebred steers on fescue over a period of a couple of years. We provided them with endophyte-infected tall fescue seed. As a controlled diet, we put them on orchard grass. So we looked at endophyte-infected tall fescue versus orchard grass. And we even added seed to the diet in some parts of the study to really bump up those ergot alkaloid concentrations in the diet to really see if there's any benefit to using a heat-tolerant breed. And we looked at some behavioral traits and some physiological traits relative to thermal regulation or body temperature regulation as well as growth. And to kind of give you a guide to the graphs I'm going to show you, we've got a Hereford set on orchard grass, a Hereford on tall fescue, centipole on orchard grass, centipole on tall fescue. The tall fescue diet increased shade utilization in both breeds. So both breeds seem to be having a problem with body temperature. Respiration rates also increased, particularly in the centipole cattle. They really had a jump in respiration rates. To kind of show you what the experimental groups look like, in the foreground we have cattle that were on fescue, our centipole and our Hereford animals, up under the shade, seeking the shade. The Herefords would even lay in the mud. In the background, we have our orchard grass animals. And you see, they're out grazing. They're not really having the same problem. And remember, these were spending 80 to 90% of their time up under the shade. Herefords were looking for ways to dissipate body heat, standing in little ponds of water. Some of them were too lazy to go out to the field. They had to jump in their water tank to try to cool off. Anything to dissipate this body heat. Again, laying in the mud up under the shade, they create these mud wallers, even out in the sun. Typically, the animals on fescue, if they were Hereford, they always have these cakes of mud. They'd be covered in mud. The centipole cattle, outside of a little bit of mud on their hooves, you really wouldn't see them caked in mud. We never saw Hereford or centipole laying in the mud, even though they were showing these other signs of heat stress. Panting, this was something that we commonly saw in those animals. Panting again, open mouth breathing, and even the centipole cattle. You say, well, these are heat tolerant animals, they're not going to get heat stress, but we really heat stress these animals. As you can see, not only did the Herefords have open mouth breathing, but also the centipole. Interestingly enough, though, when we looked at the growth, this is over 12 weeks on fescue, the Hereford cattle had a typical drop in performance. But look at the centipole cattle on the same tall fescue diet. No drop in performance in these animals. So, and these are full-blood centipole steers that we're looking at. So that indicated that there is something there that we need to consider as far as use of diversity in our cattle breeds. Over the winters, we would keep them on orchard grass diets, and the question always comes up, well, how are these animals going to do in the wintertime? These cattle have very little to no shelter, and this was in a snowstorm in the centipole right out there with the Herefords. Second year, we didn't have an effective diet on the thermoregulatory traits as far as shade use. We had, of course, the breeds were different because the centipole are heat tolerant. When we looked at respiration rates, no effective diet, just the centipoles had lower respiration rates. But again, even the second year when we didn't have clinical signs of heat stress or hypothermia, in the second year on tall fescue, the Hereford cattle had a typical drop in growth. The centipole cattle, we didn't see the same drop in performance. So this was done over 2 years. And we've got a third year of data showing the same types of relationships, looking at these breed by diet interactions. And so it seemed to indicate that there may be, again, the potential to use some type of heat-tolerant genetics to help overcome some of the problems of fescue toxicosis. And we're continuing to do some work. We've got blood samples that we've collected. We're going to look at some hormonal profiles of these animals, see if there's some endocrine mechanism that may explain the ability of these centipole cattle to withstand that fescue challenge and still perform. That didn't address the cow issue, though. We've seen this in post-weaning growth. The research that hasn't been done is on the cow side. Would a cow with some type of heat tolerance be able to withstand the fescue challenge in terms of pregnancy rates, reproductive rates? And we're also interested in looking at these animals in terms of a crossbred package. We looked at full-blood centipoles. We're interested in looking at them in terms of an F1, for instance. Does the F1 centipole show that same type of resilience under the endophyte-infected tall fescue challenge? So in closing, when we think of the phenotype or animal performance, we have to consider both the production environment. You might want to do something to your pastures, you know, renovate your pastures, get rid of that old Kentucky 31 and put in something else, dilution, some other things. Or you might want to look at it in terms of animal genetics. Can we, over decades, maybe develop lines of cattle that are tolerant of the fescue? Or maybe through our breeding program, if we infuse some type of heat-tolerant genetics through crossbreeding, is that a possible and a viable means of overcoming fescue toxicosis in our production system? So I thank you for your time and your attention. Hopefully I haven't gone over too far. And I'll kind of turn it back over to